introduced this inaugural cyber seminar for the first of three awards we started this year. This award is for Best Mentor. We also have awards for Best Paper and Best Health Service Impact, and those presentations will be coming shortly, and I encourage you to look for them. When we set out to produce these, create these awards to really recognize things that are the core of what we do but aren't always recognized fully for the people who put in such time, the idea came up to name some of these awards. And it was amazing how quickly people settled on naming the Best Mentor Award after Dan Dakin. We never could settle on a consensus to name any of the other two awards, but everyone seemed to be agreed on how great an idea it was to honor Dan through this award. I didn't have the privilege of working with Dan. He actually began his career as a basic scientist and hematologist doing work in thrombosis, in which he has over 150 publications. He has a distinguished career at various Boston institutions, starting at Harvard, becoming a professor at Tufts, and then later in his career, a long history as a professor of medicine at BU, and then a professor of public health and health services at the BU School of Public Health. But we're really honoring Dr. Dakin for his seminal role as one of the early directors of health services research at VA, a position he held from 1988 to 1996. And that was a period of incredible growth in what was then a sort of a fledgling division. And it was during that time that he established the Career Development Award, which has become really one of the jewels of our health services research program. And I think Dan recognized the importance of developing people early in their career and recognized the importance of mentoring in the growth of early investigators. And it's that commitment both to individual mentees, but also to research in general that we're honoring by naming this award after him. And it's great that he'll be able to introduce an outstanding recipient of the first award, Mark Punick. So, Dan, take it away.
Thanks so much, David. And I'm very grateful for the honor of this named mentorship. I consider it sort of a capstone to what I consider a loving relationship with the VA that began actually in 1973 when I became chief of medicine at the Boston VA. When we first decided to initiate the HSRD Career Development Program, I really wanted to distinguish it from the traditional NIH and VA medical care career development awards. And then I really felt that the new awardees would benefit from, and the VA would benefit from, a close partnership with a dedicated mentor. So we made the quality of the mentoring relationship a prime determinant for reception of the Career Development Award. And I feel there can't be any better testament to the fulfillment of that decision than the present award to Dr. Mark Punick. Mark received his Career Development Award 15 years ago under the mentorship of Carol Ashton. His accomplishments since then have been truly outstanding. He's now a tenured professor in the Department of Medicine at Baylor and director of the South Central MIREC, which this year has an annual budget of $25 million. From today's perspective, he has, to paraphrase Dr. Laura Peters' nominating letter, been whoppingly productive, with more than 200 publications, many career awards, and in general, a distinguished career in academic health services and medicine. What's perhaps more crucial is that he's mentored over 75 trainees, of whom more than a dozen have actually themselves received career development awards, a huge return for HSR&D's investment. Dr. Punick represents all and more of the initial promise of the HSRD development program, and It's truly an honor for me to introduce the first Dakin Mentoring Award recipient. And now, Mark, the program is yours.
Thank you. Thank you so much to Dr. Dakin, and thank you to Dr. Atkins and HSR&D, and thank you so much to Dr. Peterson, Laura Peterson, who nominated me for this award. I too, am so thankful for my career in the VA and my career development award. So I've had so many good mentors along the way. Alex, I need help.
You should be able to click anywhere on the screen with your mouse, and that will...
Oh, there we go. I've had so many good mentors along the way, and I thought best to start at the beginning, my bar mitzvah. Not the best looking in the family. Not the best. But I had always had a loving family. I'm so grateful to have had my grandparents who instilled in me a great love for older adults and always had the utmost confidence in me and always had me striving to do my best. My mother and father, my father's a dentist. He urged me to go into medicine, and to this day, pushes me and everybody in our family to have high goals and to attain excellence. My mom's a teacher. And she has always been very appreciative and encouraging of my my academic career. I'm really so lucky to have grown up in a nurturing, loving, privileged family with two brothers and four step siblings and a really kind of privileged background. Although I pulled this picture out, I hadn't seen it in 30 years, and I'm like, what's going on over here? I mean, it's my bar mitzvah. These pants just don't seem to be fitting quite right. So we all remember our first mentor, and I had a remarkable mentor. I was one of the things that people remember me for in high school was, this is me. This is what most people saw of me in high school. Me with a camera around my neck and pressed against my face. Not a great look for high school. But it was my passion. The passion, largely came was inspired by my mentor, a high school English teacher, creative writing teacher, Shakespeare teacher, but whose love and passion was photography. And so he led our high school photography team, and he spent so many hours with me and with all of us, talking with us, giving us hard truths about our black and white photographs that we developed in the dark room. He gave positive feedback. He pushed us to go beyond our comfort zone in a way that motivated all of us. He inspired. And he spent so much time with us. Looking back, it's just remarkable because this was not his core of his work, but he spent so much time, and I know that, going through it, I just thought of it as his job. But I know that looking back now, he just spent so much time, and I know that that was because it was his passion. He loved it, and we all we all felt that, and you know, we're all thankful for that. And I'm thankful, you know, for having that wonderful model as a first mentor. You know, as I was thinking back about Mr. Borgerding, Roland Borgerding, I pulled, you know, as we do when we reach this age, we pulled back on some of our memories, and I remembered that at the time in high school, I became a private pilot when I was 16 years old, and I got my pilot's license when I was 17. I had few passengers. not a big surprise. But I had a few passengers. I had my my mother, a few friends, and Roman Borgerding. He went flying with me, and because he wanted to take aerial photos of the school, but I know, you know, looking back, it was, you know, it was really his confidence in me, and it was so, you know, so meaningful to me. So, yeah, so many good mentors along the way. I had a wonderful start of my career as a clinician educator, and it was really struggling to find my way as a researcher, and was lucky that that Carol Ashton, Nelda Ray, and Greer Sullivan, you know, found something in me and invested in me and was a mentor for me in my career development award. And I've been at Baylor and the VA for almost 30 years now since I started medical school, and there's so many people that have inspired me and have been good mentors to me along the way. Yeah, so I started off as a clinician educator. I'm running a geropsychiatry inpatient teaching service at the Houston VA hospital with my dear friend and colleague Victor Molinari. And during that time, we had lots of people to it's surprising looking back, because I was just a year or 2 years out, but there was a surprising number of people to mentor at the time, medical students and psychology trainees and residents, all looking for some research experience. And we had no money, zero, no grants, but we had wonderful veterans who had terrible psychiatric illnesses who we tracked and who we looked at when they came in and when they left, and so we were able to do some outcomes papers on our geropsychiatry unit. We kept a database, and we probably wrote close to 40 or 50 papers, you know, during those 7 or 8 years, and almost all of them had a trainee, you know, on it, and many of the trainees were first authors, and it really shows that you don't have to have money, you know, to have good experiences for mentees, particularly mentees at this level. I went on after that and got my career development award in 1998, and since then have been much more a health service researcher first and a clinician educator second. And then we've continued to have medical students and residents and psychology trainees and other trainees from other disciplines, but I've have more and more junior faculty and postdocs, and so I'm going to talk a little bit about mentoring persons from different levels in their career development. First, I want to talk a little bit about what I see as quality. qualities of a mentor? What does it take to be excellent as a mentor? And I don't have all these qualities, I promise. But these are some of my thoughts on it. I don't fancy myself as a natty professor, and you probably gathered that from now. You see pictures of me from 13 and 16, and I promise you, I haven't evolved much from a fashion standpoint. When Dr. Atkins told me that I'd won this award and also told me that I was going to give a talk, I ran across a book review on this book, The Natty Professor by Tim Venn, and I thought, wow, this might be interesting. It's about mentoring. It might be interesting to try to tie this into my talk. I don't know how many of you know about Project Runway. For those of you in the cyber world, it's about 50% of the live audience, which surprises me, because generally, in my experience, the popular culture and sports IQ in these settings is not that high. So maybe it's just me. I've seen two episodes of Project Runway over the 14 years that Project Runway's been on the air. So Project Runway, Tim Gunn was actually a chair of design. Before coming to Project Runway, which is a kind of reality design show, from what I gather. So I started reading through this book and looking for tips on mentoring, and I regret to say that it was mostly stories about different episodes of A Project Runway, a very difficult read for me. But bottom line, for those 50% that don't watch Project Runway, I'm saving you some reading. Bottom line, I really like some of his mentoring philosophy, and this is just kind of the bottom line of the book. So he has his teach philosophy, truth-telling. It's so important to be able to be honest and to give hard truths when you need to give them. The next two on his list are particularly fortunate for a psychiatrist. One of them is empathy. I believe hugely in the importance of empathy and in mentoring. It's such a difficult. Having that confidence in your mentee goes a long way. helps to inspire, along with, you know, them seeing you doing what you really love, to do, and having them see that that this time with them is their time, or your work with the mentee is for them. I think is important, and hoping for the best, which I also think of as letting go, and I see that as, you know, some mentees, you know, are going to meet all of their goals and your shared goals that you set, and that's fantastic, and it brings a time where you need to let go. Which is also can be difficult, but is fantastic, you know, when that happens. But then there's other times too where your mentees don't reach their goals, you know, or the goals that you've set together, and that's terribly difficult, you know, for both of you. And it's important, I think, it's important as a mentor, you know, to be able to let go of that that as well, and to be able to move on from that, because that comes with the experience and the honor of mentoring. So a few other ones. I'm gonna skip the ones on the left side of the screen because Tim Gunn covered those pretty well. And I mentioned, it really is all about the mentee. Yes, it's great, you know, if you have a mentee, and it's best if you have a mentee that shares, you know, some, you know, that you share some passions, some research areas with. And yes, it's nice, you know, if what your mentee does helps to advance your career, but that's not, you know, maybe that's what it's about a little bit more early in your career, but that's not what it's about. It really is about the mentee. You know, if you take on a mentee, you know, it needs to be about helping the mentee reach their goal, and that takes that takes a lot of commitment and a lot of time. And I mentioned passion. We believe in celebrating successes. Sometimes there's quite a long time between successes in this business. And it's important to take a step back and reflect and celebrate those times, and a little bit of transparency is helpful too. I remember sometimes where, you know, my mentees were surprised when I told them that I've had times where I've submitted grants several times and they didn't get funded ever, or I've submitted papers to journals that they got rejected by more than two or three journals, and you know, that I think that goes a long way with mentees. So mentoring excellence, you know, doesn't only require, you know, the right qualities. It really requires the right environment, because it does take so much time to do it. You know, it's critical to be, you know, if you're going to do a lot of mentoring, you love mentoring, you need to be in a place that recognizes the time and effort needed, you know, for mentoring. And, I'm so thankful, you know, for the VA, and for the, particularly for HSR&D Centers of Excellence and the MIREC, you know, where mentoring and career development are a key part of the mission. In the clinical setting, although I said I did a lot of mentoring early in my career, in the clinical setting, it's increasingly difficult to, unfortunately, to spend a lot of time doing mentoring because of the need to do a lot of clinical work, the clinical demands. I put awards down. You know, it's not critical to have awards. I'm thankful for this award. I assure you. And it's nice to have them, but you must, of course, do this for intrinsic reasons. But if you're looking for places or you're at a place, that recognizes mentors or that recognizes teaching, that's a good sign. You're in a good place. And then I think one of the secrets I think to excellence in mentoring is having a pipeline of excellent mentees, and to have a pipeline of excellent mentees in psychology and medicine, social work and nursing, and is incredibly valuable. And not everybody has a great pipeline, and I have been fortunate, and I think it's important, that is a factor when you look at how well you can do as a mentor. One of the factors is how much opportunity you get, and what kinds of what kinds of opportunities, and I've been lucky to get lots of great mentees. Sometimes you get a choice. Sometimes you don't. depending on where you are in your career and the setting that you're at. But when you do have a choice, I think some of the most critical skills, to me, are writing skills. That's one that's difficult to teach. And the kinds of research and the research setting, looking at their training record and their experience in research training education, and are they proven successful? I've had some excellent mentees where I've gotten a lot of credit, and certainly I've helped them. But it was pretty much a no-brainer that you knew that they were going to do well, and that's great to be able to have a few mentees that are in that camp. And then looking at motivation, a lot of people that come to us for mentoring are intrinsically motivated, but I have had lots of persons that have come to me for mentoring because they had to do their thesis, or they were required to do a paper, or that if they got a paper published, they would get a step increase at the VA. When there is a choice. those are ones that I try not to say yes to. It's never easy to say no, but it's important to say no so that you and your mentees have the best chance of succeeding. So a little bit about the structure. I'm a 30-minute mentoring person. I don't know about you, and I don't know what the mean time for mentoring, but pretty much almost all of my mentoring meetings are 30 minutes, and I know that's probably on the short side. I don't think anybody does less than 30 minutes mentoring meetings, but I feel like the 30 minutes you've got to really be focused to get things done in 30 minutes, and I'm not sure what I would say over an hour. 30 minutes is just right. And, again, for those who know me, know that I like walking meetings. And having a couple mentor meetings a week that are walking meetings is good for everybody, and shows a good health habit from their mentor, and good for me as well. And of course, 30 minutes meetings, those are usually in person meetings, and there's lots of work in between those meetings as well. No matter what level somebody is at in their training, having specific timely goals are important, and I'll go over some of the ones I see for different levels. And again, depending on somebody's level, being able to offer resources is wonderful. So whenever I can, I do, and whenever you can, you should. Some simple things are, somebody's writing one of their first articles, or they're writing it in a new area or a new type of journal, giving them examples of articles, or if it's one of their first grants, finding, helping them find successful funded grants to use as examples is very helpful. If they need some RA support and you have some RA support, being able to offer a little bit of RA support, postdocs in particular can make a little bit of RA help go a long way, and it's always appreciated. I'm lucky to have a wonderful medical writer who works with me, Nora Hudson. And this is a great resource for mentees, particularly mentees that are having some difficulty writing, but her work, her edits help all, and help me as well, because if I need to spend 75% of my time doing, correcting language, that leaves a lot less time for science, a lot less time to do other mentoring or other things that I need to take care of. So having a medical writer is extremely useful. And having if you don't have a medical writer, having somebody on your team that has good writing skills that you might be able to use for that, I think is great. Statistical support, I think that's the thing. And then I think a big role is always to help with networking and connecting to other folks that will help them in their career. So I'm going to say a few words about tailoring for different mentees. It's the first for kind of persons that have short-term research experiences. And so these are often persons that maybe have 1 month. Our residents during some year, medical students often have 1 month or 2 months, 50% time or 80% time, to work with us. And are the psychology interns, may have 8 hours a week for 6 months. What kinds of things can you do, during that type of experience? Usually their goals are to get a product, or to develop, for particularly medical students, it's just to get a taste of research. And I find, the best for this level is to try to write a paper, a product, that can be done in a month or two. That gives them some experience with literature reviews. It gives them some experience. They learn more about doing critical appraisals. They learn something about writing skills, and they get a product at the end, and then, you know, and this is a high bar for them to get something done in a month or 2 months, but it keeps them going. And most of the students that I work with that are highly motivated, you know, can get it done if you give them a high bar. As I was reflecting back at this, I was remembering some times that I had with my buddy Victor in the 90s when I was overly ambitious. In this, and we'd really challenge our trainees and challenge ourselves, really. And that's why this came to an end. That, to try to get out, a manuscript within 4 weeks, you know, and so what does that require? That requires having an existing database where you already have your IRB approvals, or you do a systematic literature review, and you set impossible goals, or nearly, seemingly impossible goals, and you go to it. And, I was surprised, you know, how many medical students, could get this done. But, this required a lot of hours from me and Victor and others to get through these timelines. Here's another one. I just found these in my files. These are the kind of typical outlines that we would give students at the beginning of the week. So now, occasionally if I get a student who's right, we'll do 8 weeks. But even that is looking more and more difficult each year. So what else do students at this level need help with? Well, of course they need help first they need help with an idea. They should start with that. You know, most medical students, residents, or others at this level, you know, don't come with ideas, or if they do come with ideas, they're usually 4-year grant ideas that they think they could do in a short period of time. And so having a list of ideas, or having the database and the variables, and thinking about possible questions that might be answered from your database that would be interesting and useful is needed for students at this level. And then you have to help them pick out journals. So giving them a list of journals, and this has come up over time, and these articles, don't usually wind up in JAMA. I've never done anything that I haven't been proud of and that I couldn't defend, but in reality, over time, I've come to believe that. For these articles with these students, that the experience and the training that go along with this is equally important, to the science, from where I'm sitting, and that's not easy to swallow, really, and I still think about that. Said a lot, but if you want to make these experiences available for students, I think you have to have that talk with yourself. You don't want to submit these articles, to journals where you're 95% certain they're not going to get accepted. And continue to do that, because these students are gone. Well, their 2 months are after their 2 months, they're gone, and you're left with the rejections and the revisions, and they're taking call on internal medicine. So it's important to kind of balance that. They talked about the medical writer. Recognizing the student. I'm surprised that that more people don't do this. For example, for the medical students here at Baylor, they have research symposiums, not just for medical students, for all disciplines. They have research symposiums for the students. They have research symposiums in geriatrics, and they give awards. They're not big awards, but they're meaningful to the students, and it really helps to build them up and to get them more excited about academic careers and research careers, and they see that you also have confidence in them and believe in them and are investing in them by looking for these opportunities. So with postdocs, the stakes go up and the challenges increase. These are usually two-year opportunities, and the goals are to continue to learn the foundations of research, to develop their own area of research and an area that's independent, from the mentors. Researchers, they learning grantsmanship, starting to increase the amount of papers that they have, and to think about preparing career development awards, where your first job is going to be. That's a lot in 2 years, and I think it's complicated and made even more challenging by that at the end of year one. They need to be thinking about what's going to happen after their career development. After the postdoc, and so that makes planning complicated. Makes planning complicated, I think. Definitely challenging. I think at this level, I think it's a good level to incorporate a mentoring team. I think it's good for. It's good for you, for me as a mentor. I love the team mentoring experience, and I think it gives the mentees different views and different expertise. And I like, whenever possible, to include somebody who's not from your immediate institution, because I get somebody who's a little bit separated, and maybe can give a little bit different advice, particularly about jobs. As far as mentoring teams, having the quarterly mentoring team meetings, I think it's important to bring people together so that the mentees aren't getting too many different views, and that the mentors understand where each is coming from. I put challenge of MD fellows because I'm very saddened that it's so difficult. It's become increasingly difficult to recruit MD fellows to research, it is a different challenge. A lot of MD fellows don't have the foundation. Most of them don't have the research foundation as a PhD fellows, and so the timing is different. The tailoring is different from them, and I think the timeline needs to be extended a little for them. So moving on to junior faculty, here the goal is to establish a research foundation and for them to establish their own research agenda to obtain their first grant. Whether that be a CDA or merit or an R01. I still think there needs to be weekly meetings that people know that I try. If I'm in town, we're meeting, and I continue to do weekly meetings really until somebody's promoted or tenured, and that's a long period of time. That's six to 9 years. And people may think that Probably most of my mentees think it's too long. But, you know, I think it's important to have that consistency and, to, you know, you change the things that you speak about, and, you know, maybe start speak more about higher impact work and, you know, what's going to happen after the career development award. And again, you know, setting some high goals. You know, one of the goals that I always set is my rule of five, which makes people anxious. which is that you should be moving in the direction of having five papers published in the past year, five papers in press, five under review, and five in preparation, so that you work your way to hopefully publishing somewhere around five papers a year. And I know many of you over the line, I can feel your anxiety. but I think it's a good. I think the main point of it is to set some high bars and set some bars, you know, that, you know, appropriate for your institution, for the person that you're mentoring, and where they want to go. I'm sticking with the five. A little bit on some experiments in mentoring. I told you about the 30 minutes. I'm stuck on that. Group mentoring. I've done some group mentoring over the years, and my conclusion is that the mentees like it less than I do. Nice. People say it's nice to share, but I think at the end of the day, people definitely want time, and so I don't know. I don't think these have been that experiment. I don't think has been that successful, but I'm sure there's a place for it, and I'm sure I'll revisit it at times. But I don't know. Not satisfying, I don't think, from either standpoint. It's just a couple of just quickly to finish up, just briefly talk about, you know, and hopefully can move others to kind of think about other models for mentoring, and just tell you about some kind of meta mentoring work that I've done over the years. One was done earlier in my career, and that was this 5% solution. You know, so coming from a background as a clinician, educator, you know, it really, really does sadden me, you know, that there's not, that it's more and more difficult to do scholarly work for a lot of our clinicians. And so I try to help our administration and our clinicians, you know, come up with a plan. This is when I was on psychiatry, to come up with a plan that would kind of meet the administrators' kind of demands for accountability and kind of suspiciousness for what goes on during the academic hours, and the needs of the clinicians to do some scholarly work. So I came up with this 5% solution. And what this was, you know, I told the head of the Mental Health Care Line at the time, you know, if they would agree to free up, you know, a couple hours a week or 4 hours a week for academic time, I would do the accounting and I would do the evaluating. And I came up with, a crazy template for, you know, what would be expected, you know, what would be agreed upon for the year for them to get, you know, 2 or 4 hours out of their time, out of their clinical time to do more academic work. And then I would do an accounting at the end of the year and send a letter to the, you know, both the clinician educator and to the clinical leadership. And this worked well for, I'd say, 5 or 6 years, probably 5 years. And you know, then there was change of leadership, and it didn't work as as well with that. And it's not fair to just say change in leadership. I mean, it's change in time also. But, again, I bring this up as a kind of an experiment that was partially successful, but also, in hopes, that all of us, can continue to struggle with, how to find ways to do teaching, scholarly the work, and mentoring, within the current environment. This training residence in psychiatry scholarship program is a program that I started to try to get more physicians to enter into research careers, particularly psychiatry residents. We have through the MIREC, we have a physician research fellowship. It's difficult to get physicians to apply for these, and so through some of the IOM, one of the IOM reports, one of the big barriers was that physicians don't have any models or any exposure to kind of research clinicians during their training. So I designed a program for PGY2 second year psychiatry residents from all around the South Central United States medical schools in the South Central U.S. that were affiliated with the VA, for them to pick out a promising PGY2 resident that had some academic potential. And then what we did with those residents is we brought them together at a meeting in the South Central U.S. and I and others did a kind of a 4-hour kind of academic career workshop with them, and then we matched them up with kind of mental health researchers, mentors at their sites. And those mentors, kind of primary aim was to help them with kind of academic career counseling, but then also help to get them started on some projects, and then also we provided them with an honorarium, and in this program is in its 12th year, and I think this program has helped to get more residents to enter into academic careers. But, unfortunately, we haven't had that much success in getting them into research, careers. But I think, programs like this, can be helpful to at least increase the pipeline from medical school and residency. So, yes, mentoring and teaching are great gifts, and I am so appreciative of getting this award, and so appreciative of the VA for making mentoring and for persons like Dr. Bacon to create programs like the Career Development Award, which really recognize the importance of developing the next generation, and recognize the importance of mentoring. With that, thank you for your attention, and thank you so much for this recognition.
Thank you very much, Dr. Koenig, and of course, Dr. Dakins and Atkins, for providing introductions and for all three of you being here. We do have some time for some Q&A for our attendees that joined us after the top of the hour. If you'd like to submit a question or a comment, just use the question section of your GoToWebinar dashboard. Just hit the plus sign next to the word questions, type it in, and we'll get to it in the order that it is received. Several congratulations have already come in, but we'll get to the questions. I know that you have been especially successful at supervising students from a variety of different disciplines. Any thoughts on cross-disciplinary research mentoring?
I think number one is to understand better what their goals are, because it's not always obvious to somebody from another discipline what their goals are for the experience. So I think trying to understand what their goals are and then coming up with an agreed upon upon goal, you know, I think it is always a good place to start. But yeah, listening to what their needs are in their, and whatever discipline they're in.
Thank you for that reply. I do want to give your audience a chance to ask questions as well. Is there anyone in there with their hand up?
No, saving it for later.
Okay. Sounds good. All right. Well, the next one came in, starts with a comment, and moves on into a question. Perhaps one possible way to have more clinicians who are truly interested in academic and research careers would be to select medical students and postdocs who have already done some research. I admit to bias, as I did 3 undergraduate research projects, but I find that postdoc training is way too late to get them truly interested, as well as possession of the scientific mindset. Do you have a comment on this?
I strongly believe in that, and and trying to provide, just like the STRIPS program, trying to provide, some opportunities. I mean, there are a lot of medical schools now, that will offer combined degrees, that offer, more opportunities to research, not just the MD, PhD, but some alternatives to MD, PhD. And there are residencies, that have research tracks as well, so that during the the 4 years, sometimes they're 5 years, or sometimes they're able to build in a substantial research experience and training into the residency time. I think all those models are good.
Thank you for that reply. The next question, can you share your thoughts about long-distance mentorship at the postdoc level?
I'm doing some of that. I think it's doable. It's establishing usually when that happens, it's some kind of more narrow area. You're not the primary mentor. You are the geropsychiatry, expert, or some more narrow area. So I think it's doable. It's just setting what the roles are and what the expected times of meeting are, and then getting together with the local mentors on a regular basis, I think is often helpful. My biggest problem really with long distance mentoring is usually the mentees actually don't have the confidence that I'm as invested when I'm long distance. I don't feel like I'm being utilized enough.
Thank you for that reply. Next question. Let's see. What is the process of finding a mentor? It's been nearly 2 years since my postdoc, and I haven't found one. What are the common expectations for both mentor and mentee?
Ooh, it's been longer than 2 years since I found one. I think, I would say that the best place to find them really is a center of excellence. Some kind of research center of excellence, whether it's HSR&D or PADREC or GRAC, some type of research center of excellence is the best place, I think, to find a mentor. As far as expectations, I think it just depends, on where somebody is and what they're looking for. Again, I think that should be one of the initial, discussions.
Can you explain more about what the expectations of a mentor are? I'm sorry, this is worded a little interesting. What are the expectations of a mentor from a mentee?
I think, number one, to kind of be there for them, and to help them meet their goals, to help clarify what the expectations are on both sides, on the side of the mentor and the side of the mentee, and I would hope that the mentors have a number of the qualities that I mentioned.
Thank you. One person did comment that they find local mentors taking the burden in situations where there are distant mentors. That's an excellent point. The next question, and forgive me if these numbers don't make sense to me, -2555 productivity goal. Do you mean first author papers, or does this include co-authorship?
That sounds like a winner. However, send me an email. I like it. One of my mentees also wants to know that in the room. I think at least a couple of each of those five, maybe half of those, each of those should be a first or as you move on in your career, seeing your author papers.
Excellent. Well, you do have, do you have a slide? I believe, can you move to the last slide that has your contact information?
Yes, sir.
There we go. So for the person that submitted the 555 question, there is his contact information, and feel free to get him offline. I do want to check, do you have any questions in the audience?
No, we're good.
Not at this time? Okay. Well, we have reached the end of our questions that were in the queue, and we have reached the top of the hour. So we've got one more question that just came in. I have a mentor with very limited time, but he is an exemplary researcher. How do I get some time with him? I don't want to be a nuisance, but I want the mentoring.
I guess I would push it, to see whether it's possible or not. And if it's not possible, seeing if you can fill off the team, with others, who would be able to give you the skills and time that you need.
So you're not suggesting they camp out in front of the office?
No.
Okay. All right. Well, as I said, that was the last question. So I want to thank you very, very much for presenting, not just to your live audience, but also to the attendees that joined us. And congratulations again on getting such an accolade. And a lot of people are writing in saying, great job, great work, terrific presentation. Thank you. Congratulations. And I'm sure you'll hear much more. You'll get much more of that at the national meeting when you get the live award. So I want to thank you again. And do you have any concluding comments you'd like to give real quick, Mark?
No, thank you. Thanks, everybody, for attending. And thanks for all the congratulations.
Excellent. Thank you. And again, thanks to Dr. Atkins and Dr. Dakin for joining us today. So this does conclude today's HSR&D Cyber Seminar. And thank